Welcome everyone to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 193, and I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me today, back from an absence last week, is John Lindemann.
Howdy, y'all.
Very good to have you, sir.
Good to be back.
And, of course, James Jones. JJ.
Hey.
Yeah. And Greg Leahy.
It's 2 a.m. on election night. They've been queuing round the block in some places. It's the closest election for a generation. So get the kids out of bed, because it's time for Radio Free Nintendo.
Awesome. Yeah, I didn't even remember choosing the nominees for the next retroactive. Apparently, though, it's doing gangbusters.
I'm sure that would be far more orderly.
So I congratulate Greg on his social upheaval, and hope he won't be too distracted tonight, because we got a lot to talk about.
If I just occasionally say, democracy, you're like, oh, I could cut that out later.
So, okay, it's time for new business, and John is first.
My new business is Monster Hunter Tri. I was meaning to talk about it last week, but I've had some more time to kind of put into the online component of it.
I can't wait to hear what you say. I've been hearing a little bit about it on Weekend Confirmed with Billy, and I'm with the home variety.
Yeah, I'm liking it a lot. Actually, we've done the Monster Hunter Club with some people from the forums every Tuesday at 10 p.m. Eastern. We hop on there and run through some quests. But yeah, I mean, it's really good. I really like it. Of course, there's some goofiness with the friend codes and stuff. And even though it doesn't use friend codes, the way that it's implemented, that you do get a Capcom ID, and you have to swap that with people, and it's just kind of...
Well, how is that better than friend codes?
It's really not.
Just called something different?
Well, the only thing that kind of makes it better is that it's automated, sort of. Like, you send somebody a friend request, and then they kind of accept it, but you kind of have to take your ID and put it into their friend request, or they can't accept it. It's really goofy.
But it's not a 12-digit number.
No, it's not. It's 6.
That you absolutely both have to enter.
It's 6, so it's 50% better.
We've quantified it.
Yeah, it's still goofy. It still takes a while to kind of populate your friends list. But once you do, it's really, really easy. You can just select somebody from your friends list, and assuming that they aren't in a quest, the quest can be up to 4 people. And as long as they aren't in a quest, you can warp to them. So sometimes, you kind of have to, if somebody is online, if you try to warp to them, it'll say that they're in a quest, so you can't hop right in. But still, I mean, much better than most online things I've seen on the Wii.
You've been using WeSpeak?
Yeah, WeSpeak still sucks. Mm-hmm. It's still really bad.
Shocking.
I haven't used mine since the conduit last summer.
I didn't really even use it during the conduit, because all I ever got was...
Yeah, it's really bad. I mean, it's really disappointing that it sucks as bad as it does.
It's almost impressive how bad it sucks. I mean...
are we talking a golf ball and garden hose impressive?
A little bit. It's like a reverse layer of difficulty. Like, they swung the pendulum back so far the other way. How could they possibly have made it this bad?
Yeah. I mean, it almost does make the game harder in some ways, because a lot of times if somebody says something to you, there's like this kind of like little exchange, right? Like, blah, 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 blah. What? Blah, 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 blah. What? And then you get killed. So you'll see a lot of that kind of stuff. So I just try to stay away from WeSpeak. Also, the fact that you have
coordination, everyone.
I know, exactly. And a lot of times I just try to stay away from it, because it comes through your speakers, and yeah, of course you have to turn, because you can't hear it in the first place. You have to turn your stereo up to even hear it. So everybody within like a mile of you can hear exactly what's going on WeSpeak. I mean, my wife was just like, turn it down. I don't want to hear it.
Oh, I can't wait until I get John on WeSpeak. Be like, John! John!
John, I thought you had like wireless headphones or something that you used.
I do that.
No, I was apparently you can use some of the ones that were packed in with some PS2 games, which just like normal USB wireless mics. Mm-hmm. Apparently work.
Oh, really?
I see.
I was gonna say, actually, I'm surprised that I haven't heard about people modding WeSpeak or like creating their own
WeSpeak
sort of version of it.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it's something that the game is doing specifically.
Well, yeah, there's definitely like an API that Nintendo provides that involves some attempt at noise cancellation and the processing for all that, but it seems like there's got to be something that you could plug in, that the system would recognize as WeSpeak, even though it's not.
Yeah.
So it would do the same processing, but your hardware itself would be higher quality.
Yeah, because I know one of the guys on the forums, he just happened to say that, oh yeah, you know, I just use, because we were complaining about WeSpeak, and he just happened to say, yeah, I just use one of the USB headsets that I got with one of my PS2 karaoke games. And I was like, what? But apparently it works. But I typically just use a USB keyboard.
You know, I have a USB headset. I could try it, and we could see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, give it a try.
Well, James, do you have Monster Hunter?
Well, no, but I have the WeSpeak channel. We could try it on that.
Yeah, okay. So, John, what about the game itself? I mean, you actually, unlike a lot of people who've been playing and talking about Try, you have actually played the previous Monster Hunter games on PSP. So,
yeah.
What's your take on it? I mean, does it feel like a true sequel? Does it feel different?
It's much better. Playing it with a second analog stick that controls the camera makes all the difference. It makes it so you can sit there and, you know, run around a monster in a circle. Because, I mean, pretty much in that game, you're always on the run. Because what they'll do is you're not just fighting one huge boss monster. A lot of times that monster will call in its underlings. And so you'll be getting chased by 3, 4, 5 monsters at a time. So most of the time you're running around like a madman. And the problem with that on the PSP was that the way the controls were set up, you had, I think, the left shoulder button centered the camera behind you. And then if you wanted to rotate the camera around you, you had to use the D-pad. Well, the D-pad is, of course, controlled with your left thumb, and the analog stick is directly below it. So there's no way that you can move the camera while moving your guy at the same time.
We call that the PSP button layout clusterfuck.
Yeah. I mean, it's just terrible. And so what you can do in Monster Hunter Try is you can move your character with the left analog stick and just move the camera around him however you want with the right analog stick.
So then, aside from having an extra joystick, if you play with the Classic controller, of course, or the Pro,
yep.
I mean, in terms of gameplay, has very much changed. All I've ever heard about is they added underwater battles.
Yeah, the underwater battles are really cool. The overall gameplay, if you've played it on the PSP, it's almost the same as the Wii. I mean, it's reached that Dragon Quest sort of,
sameness.
It's up in that category where it's just the same thing over and over again, and if you like it, you'll like it, and if you don't, you know, you're not. There's nothing really to attract it. Even though the thing is, I think the camera controls are much better, and which is huge in itself. I mean, it's much easier to pick it up and play it because of that.
Is it more accessible in any other ways, given that this is meant to be the big breakthrough for the Western market?
I think that the ease with which you can play online is a huge hook.
Which you just bagged on about 5 minutes ago, by the way.
Well, that's, I mean, the friend code stuff. I mean, once you get the friend code stuff out of the way, I mean, once you have your friend roster all set up, it's cake to go and play with people because you just hop into a room, four of you are in a room, and one person just goes up and chooses a quest, and you just all click ready, and you're right in there. And it's a lot of fun. I mean, it's really fun to kind of cooperate and take down. I mean, like, just the other night, we did a quest where you had to, I think, take down like 3 or 4 of these big monsters. And it's pretty chaotic. You know, you have to go in there and you take your shots and then, you know, you might get hit. And then so you have to kind of back off and watch everybody else go in there and take their shots. And so it's fun. It's a lot of fun.
I mean, there's been quite a lot of comparisons drawn with MMOs and stuff.
Yeah.
And obviously you are someone who plays MMOs. So I guess I'm thinking two things. Firstly, if you are an MMO player, what does this kind of give you that MMOs don't? Or how does it give you the same thing differently? And the second component would be, if you're someone who's always been turned off by playing an MMO, why might this appeal to you if that doesn't?
Well, what it reminds me of is the gear grinding that you do in World of Warcraft, because one of the big things in World of Warcraft is, you know, once you get your character up to level 80 or max your character out, right, really there isn't much to do but go through these instanced areas where you kill a boss and you get a gear drop. That's like the big thing. So it's kind of like maxing out your character. And you do that in Monster Hunter Try. So you'll kill a monster and then you can kind of scavenge that monster. You cut some meat off of it or whatever. And then you accumulate these different ingredients to make armor. And the cool thing about that is it's all in the armor designs, because they're made to look like the monsters that they came from. So it's pretty cool being able to look at your character and your character is in full armor gear. And you can tell that it came from, you know, the Kurapeko or the Jaggi or one of these monsters kind of thing. So it's kind of like a
trophy.
Yeah, like a trophy, like a badge of courage or something. Like, it's impressive when you see other people with these crazy armor sets and you don't even know where they came from. You don't know, you know, what monster they're from or anything like that. So I would say it's a lot like something like World of Warcraft, kind of boiled down to its simplest elements, where you're just getting a small party, going out and killing a boss, and then getting gear drops, and then kind of creating your own your armor, you know, new guns, swords, and stuff like that.
So a more intensive version in terms of the gameplay packed into a smaller period of time.
Yep. Yep. It's like kind of like in smaller chunks where sometimes, you know, if you might run an instance in World of Warcraft, it could take you 2 hours. Some of the bigger ones take 3 hours. They require you to kind of set aside more time, whereas this is more, you know, little kind of bite-sized chunks.
Which I suppose may help with the accessibility issue in itself.
Yeah.
The gear grinding stuff actually sounds kind of appealing to me, but what I played of the combat in the demo, that was the turnoff for me.
the thrust of gathering the gear.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a lot different when you're playing with three other people, because it's a lot easier, first off. I mean, you can kind of like once the quest is done, you kind of sit there in the city and you can do stuff like you can sit down at a table and drink and watch your character get drunk and fall over. You can arm wrestle each other, which is pretty funny. There's all these like kind of like little kind of detailed things. But yeah, the problem with the demo is that you're fighting a monster or monsters that you don't fight until you're probably about 10 hours into the game if you're playing offline one player, because it really does. I mean, if you play the demo, you'll get a completely warped idea of what the game is like, because when you play the offline game, it eases you in really, really slowly, and it shows you exactly what to do every step of the way. Like, your first quest is just going to, like, get mushrooms or something like that, where you can't die.
I think I'm going to have to rent this, and
it's a very
kind of take my time, and it'll be kind of like Sharon the Wanderer, where I feel like I'm taking a risk on it, but I'm going to really push myself and try to expand my horizons, and if it doesn't work, that's okay.
Yeah.
But I feel like it seems interesting enough and potentially a lot of fun.
Yep.
If it does click with you, that I do kind of want to give it a chance, even though that demo fucking sucks.
It does really suck.
How do you think it passes muster for not necessarily an exclusively single player game, but for someone who's not going to be having regular multiplayer sessions, let's say, at least?
Mm-hmm. Well, as a single player game, you're going to get bored of it eventually, because there's only so much that you'll want to do by yourself. Now, you can get, I think they're called like Cha-Chas or something. They're the little, they used to be the cat characters in the PSP version. They're like a pet, like they can attack monsters with you.
Hmm.
But eventually, it's the kind of game where you're going to want to play it with other people.
So it's basically, those things are the equivalent of the bucket holders when you play Crystal Chronicles by yourself.
Very much so.
So congratulations, John, you're playing Crystal Chronicles.
Now, the single-player game is a little better just because they kind of have a plot to it. Like, there's this monster called the Lagia Chris or something where you're in this fishing village and it's causing earthquakes and all kinds of bad stuff. And so your goal in the offline one-player game is to kill this monster. But what's cool is that you can go online and you can get materials that you can use offline. So you can go online and get drops off of, you know, rare drops off of monsters, come offline and create armor using those drops, and then you can use them in the offline single player game.
And it goes the other way too, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So they're not integrated, but they affect one another.
Well, we got to move on, but I think you've done it justice.
Yeah,
you've
at least
interest.
Give it a try. At least give it a try. Mm-hmm. I think you'll have a lot of fun with it.
Cool. Give it a try, but not a demo.
No, the demo's awful. And it doesn't even show off the game the way it's actually played, really.
Right.
So.
I could kind of tell when I played it. I was like, oh, this is not a good demo.
Mm-hmm.
Level 7, let's go.
Yep.
Well, I'll tell you, a game that does have a very good demo is Picross 3D, and I'm sure that demo will be available for a while on the Nintendo channel, and it really sold me on the game. I mean, I was interested anyway. I played a little bit of it at PAX East, which was the same demo, but I just didn't have as much time with it. But when I downloaded that thing from the Nintendo channel and really went through the entire thing, I was like, this is pretty cool. I'm going to have to get it. And I didn't even, when I went to go pick it up at the store, I didn't even know it was $20. I was expecting to pay $30. So that was a pleasant surprise. But I've been playing Picross 3D very heavily for about 3 days. And I described it in our pre-show emails as crack cocaine. And I mean, it's like, I play it and it abuses me, and then I set it down and I immediately want to play more of it. So
so it's like pick crack.
It is a weird compulsion for something so kind of heartless.
It's, I mean, almost tedious in a way playing it.
But
you know?
But you can't deny there is that satisfaction with it.
Yeah. Well, I think it's designed very intelligently in the way that you attack every puzzle very methodically, which is similar to Sudoku. And there's certainly lots of similarities between Picross and Sudoku, even though they are, you know, fundamentally different games. But there are a lot of similarities in the way that you approach each puzzle. But I think what you don't get from Sudoku is the satisfaction of breaking these blocks. And you don't get that from 2D Picross either, you know, from all the other previous versions. So I think it's something that's unique to the 3D game in that it does feel like you're kind of chiseling away at a piece of rock to find the sculpture underneath. And they're very simple they're very crude sculptures. They're not always simple. Sometimes they're pretty complex. But it does feel like you're making progress and you're getting closer to the goal. And there is something really deeply addictive about the way it's all put together. And it really has nothing to do with the presentation, other than the fact that the blocks break when you clear them off, you know, when you've decided that they're not part of the final shape. Other than that, the presentation kind of sucks, I think. I mean, it's the colors are very bland. The music is just non-existent to me. I mean, I listened to it for about 20 minutes and was like, I got to put on a podcast. I can't listen to this shit.
I played plenty of the of Picross DS without the sound on. Right, because, I mean, it's that kind of game, let's be honest.
It's a zone-out thing.
But the music was better. I mean, I don't know why after it went off a cliff.
Right. It's really quite bad, the music. It's some of the worst music I've heard in a Nintendo game.
It's trivial. I mean, I kind of like the animations sometimes. They're kind of funny.
The animations are like your reward for completing the puzzle.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, it's not as intimidating as I feared it would be. You know, when they first showed this, we all thought, God, that's going to be impossible. And it's really not at all. In fact, it has an amazing tutorial. And
very
it's
thorough.
Optional, but there are a number of puzzles that are embedded in that tutorial mode.
Yeah.
And if you want to do all the puzzles and like collect all the items that you discover, you have to go through those tutorials. But it's worth doing, and there will be parts to it that you might not be able to figure out without going through the tutorial. So I didn't mind doing it. But there's just a ridiculous amount of content. I mean, Greg, you've talked about
definitely.
It. There's over 350 puzzles, plus you download more every
yeah,
week.
You can download more. You can make your own. There have been having contests over, because obviously it's been out rather longer in Europe. They've been having contests for people to make their own puzzles and things.
And you can trade them online.
It hasn't got some of the features of like the whole like multiplayer stuff and all that they had with the Picross DS. Hmm. I guess it's kind of more practical with this one, but it's still very content rich for $20. I think it was such a discount release over here. I think I got it for about the equivalent of $25, and that was kind of a good pre-order price. Hmm. So it definitely sounds like the Americans are getting a good deal there.
Yeah, it's just extremely addictive. It's a lot of fun. And the only complaint I have about Picross DS, 3D, I should say, is that, I mean, the music is not much of a complaint. Again, this is the kind
trivial.
Of game I would already want to play with my earphones in anyway, listening to something else. But my only complaint is that you have to play with the D-pad. Or, you know, if you're left-handed, you can play with the face buttons. But I wish it was touch only, because then I could set it down. Because I find that it's a game that you end up playing for quite a long time, and you'd kind of like to just put on the TV or put on your music and just kind of sit back or lay down while you play it. And it's harder to do that because you have to actually hold it with one hand and tap on it otherwise. So I wish there was at least an optional mode as far as switching between the mark and the destroy actions. I wish there was a way to kind of toggle those on and off with the touchscreen as an option.
You know, funnily enough, I think that was the default, really, in Picross DS. Was to sort of switch between them using the stylus little icons on the screen. Mm-hmm. And then you could use the D-pad buttons as a quicker way of doing that.
Sure, I can see why some people would want to use the buttons to
do it. Yeah, so but just they had both before, and if anything, the stylus mode was the more emphasized. Mm. It's interesting that because there's no functional reason I could think of that why you wouldn't do that again.
Yeah, and the other thing is that the actions for breaking blocks and marking them as a true part of the final puzzle are mapped to up and right on the D-pad, and they're so close together that a few times I have actually gotten them mixed up in the middle of a puzzle, which means I end up accidentally breaking a block that I know it should be there.
Yeah, I don't know why you wouldn't make it the opposite direction, so.
Or at least give me the option to move them around, you know, to reassign them however I see fit. But yeah, I mean, you would think the default would be up and down or left and right, and not these two adjacent directions. It's very strange to me that they would choose up and right for switching between those two, but... Anyway, that's pretty minor stuff, and that's all in the controls. But yeah, Picross 3D is awesome. Actually, it's like
$20 too. I mean, that's a great deal.
It's really a perfect DS game. I mean, like this is exactly the kind of game that I want on the DS right now. And it's just it never ends. I'm going to be playing this for months, you know, which scares me because I think about the amount that I've played it in the past 3 days, and it really terrifies me that this game kind of goes on forever.
Even if you don't play it, you know, that kind of intensive fashion, it's so easy to just come in and come out of.
Yeah, I mean, it takes like 5 minutes per puzzle.
You certainly develop a knack of doing everything quicker and all that. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've got to like the hard level now, finally, the last set. And certainly, as I sort of expressed before, the sequencing becomes a lot more sort of fiddly. It's much less self-evident what to eliminate. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the time limit of if you want to get a perfect score really starts to become more of a consideration. So you really want to get on with it and stuff. So there's definitely a weird learning curve that kind of goes through these peaks and valleys. Mm-hmm. But there is a kind of progression along all that content.
I mean, even in the easy mode, which is where I still am, I found a few puzzles that I would say are pretty challenging.
Mm.
They take some interesting logic.
It might sound like, okay, so I've got to do, you know, whatever it is, like nearly 100 easy puzzles or something. You know, what is that? Is that a bit much? But it's like I said, this kind of peaks and valleys in... Mm-hmm. Within the actual easy, normal, and hard themselves. And when you get to hard, I mean, even something like, you'll have like a puzzle that's only so 2 cubes deep. So, you know, it seems relatively simple, but mm-hmm. the sequencing is tricky.
And, you know, they can control how much information they give you.
Yeah.
So a lot of the easier puzzles, they give you more than enough numbers to solve the puzzle.
To eliminate very easily. It's just, right. It's all there for you.
As it gets harder, a lot of times there is really a very specific sequence of moves that you have to do to solve it, and you have to search around until you find the one next thing that you're able to do.
So in some ways, is that early puzzle in the hard mode, is that harder than the latter one on easy or not? Well, it's kind of harder in a different way. Yeah, so yeah. That's what's kind of good, is that it does change a little in that as much as it can, as something a game like this can.
Yeah. Anyway, Picross 3D, highly, highly recommended. And Greg, you're up next with a game in our show notes is called Blank of Blank, colon, Blank of Blank.
Might and Magic Clash of Heroes. So you've got an and in there.
There you go. You screwed it up.
Egg on my face.
Not quite the double dip on the Blank of Blank there. But we had Chris from Chicago, I think, emailed us about this a few weeks ago with the shout out. In addition to all the good reviews and all that, I decided to pick it up sort of on the strength of that. So it's going for reasonable prices here at the minute as well. It certainly helped. And I think Chris did probably a very good job of summing up its virtues more succinctly than I will, but I'm going to try. So the shortest hand way I would describe the game is turn-based strategy RPG. But where the battle grid is a match 3 puzzle game. Structurally, even though it has an overworld, it's quite similar to something like Final Fantasy Tactics A2 that I reviewed for the DS.
This all sounds a lot like Puzzle Quest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's an awful lot like Puzzle Quest, but I haven't played that directly. So, I mean, I know a fair bit about it. But, I mean, with this, you've got your main quests that you need to do to advance the story, and then you've got a bunch of side quests that you could do, like sort of bounties you could take and enemies that you could just sort of find somewhere. That will not advance the story, but it will build up your characters and the experience mm-hmm. of your units and stuff like that. So, you know, you can do a little bit of grinding in that way
mm-hmm.
if you're finding a particular story battle difficult. But, I mean, I think one of the most interesting things in it is you get these little puzzle battle things. Or I can't remember exactly what they're called, but they're literally just pure kind of puzzle, really, in the sense it's not a typical battle. Here, you've got a specific formation that you've got to make the right matches so that it will destroy everything else in one turn. That's the puzzle.
This sounds exactly like Puzzle Quest.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the case of these puzzle battles, it actually reminds me quite a lot of Planet Puzzle League for DS, yes. of the bits where you get the challenges where you have to clear a set formation of blocks with a fixed number of moves.
Mm-hmm. Oh, is it like timed?
No, it's turn-based, and so you're beginning with a fixed number of moves per turn.
Oh, okay.
And that's where the key mechanic that comes in here is the fact that if you can trigger combos, chain reactions of color matches, you're going to get, but you actually earn more moves per turn.
Okay.
Which clearly is going to give you a big advantage because it just allows you to do more per turn, activate more attacks, and build up more defensive walls. So that's how the combos really come in and affect the game. And the thing with the puzzle battles is they're kind of really showing you, in a way, how the combos work, you know, what is possible with the combo system, as well as being fiendishly difficult in their own right. I mean, for instance, I mean, I played quite a lot of Puzzle League for DS, and I would say even some of the early ones in Might and Magic compare pretty favourably with some of the tougher ones in Puzzle League. So really quite tricky, but, you know, valuable, because sometimes they're in the story part, and other times it's just a really good experience. So that's kind of cool. And they also have different kind of battles sometimes, like rather than just generally sending your attacks to the top of the enemy screen, you'll be looking at specific targets. Like, you've got to hit four sort of switches because you're opening a gate in the context of the story or something like that, you know. So they do mix it up a little bit. It doesn't get too monotonous, at least from the sort of amount that I've played of it. But, I mean, it is, like I said, it's got this feel of a strategy game. And, you know, the way it's designed is quite deliberate, in the sense that, you know, if you were just going to make matches sort of on an ad hoc basis without any strategic thinking, that is by far not going to be the most efficient way of beating the enemy. If you coordinate your attacks, if you have like two attacks of the same color at the same time, it's stronger. You know, you can clear the way for a subsequent attack. It very much requires you to hold off until the right time to sort of make all these matches and synchronize everything and all that. So it's very deliberate. But on the other hand, you've got this kind of luck component, because if you have units that attack and then you kind of bring them back later on to repopulate the puzzle field, it does that in a kind of random way. They just kind of disperse. And so sometimes they may do so and it's like, oh, there it is. There's a combo for me right there to set up. I can, I'm golden. And then other times it may do the very last thing you want it to do, and ruin, you know, whatever kind of coordinated attack you was kind of thinking of putting together. So that kind of runs really contrary to the overall kind of nature of the game otherwise for me. In a sort of fast-paced puzzle game like Meteos, I mean, some people say, like, oh, Meteos, a lot of that's luck and all that. I guess it's legitimate, but it seems a lot more acceptable to me in a game like Meteos. Whereas here, it can be a little bit jarring.
It probably keeps you from, I mean, the random factor is probably to keep you from sort of overwhelming the computer or just always doing the most optimal thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, look, you know, it's not a big problem at all. And I think you're right, that kind of uncertainty is not a terrible thing for the battles. You can keep them interesting. So with all that said, I think I have been enjoying Might and Magic quite a lot so far, though I haven't played it as much as I'd like, or as much as I might have done, because of stuff like Pokemon and Picross 3D.
Nice.
Well, once again, this is Might and Magic Clash of Heroes, and
yeah.
I hate to sound snarky, Greg, because, I mean, obviously you like the game, but I think your descriptions actually kind of turned me off of trying it, because Puzzle Quest 2 is coming out in a couple of months, and, you know, it sounds like Clash of Heroes is very similar to the first Puzzle Quest, whereas Puzzle Quest 2 is actually kind of mixing it up a little bit and not holding its predecessor to be too sacred. So that's more interesting to me right now, just because I feel like
it's a big thing. If you've already played the first Puzzle Quest, you're probably looking for something more substantially different.
Yeah, I'm sure it feels a lot fresher to you.
Yeah, having not played the first Puzzle Quest, I can't really tell you how substantially different this is. Or not. I mean, it's conceptually similar, but
what's the time frame between the release of the initial Puzzle Quest in this game?
A couple years, and there've been several clones of Puzzle Quest. I mean, several.
Dude, this one feels like one of the more brazen ones, though.
No. I mean, Puzzle Chronicles just came out on Xbox Live Arcade.
Oh, yeah, that's different. That's almost courtroom brazen, though.
I mean, and there was that damn Neopets game that Capcom did that was basically Puzzle Quest. They told us it's basically Puzzle Quest.
It's always bad when you directly describe your game, but somebody else's game.
Well, that was the E3 where they were showing off Resident Evil 5 and all this other stuff, and it was a wasteland for Nintendo content.
It was like the booth tour of EA last year. Here's all the Wii games. We're not going to go look at that. Here's your Hello Kitty shit.
Let me take you to the cool stuff. Okay, well, James?
I did want to mention something about Sinner's Punishment 2 coming out in Europe this week. It's topical now because it's coming out in Europe in a few hours, actually.
Mm. Beating us to the punch yet again?
Well, yeah, I guess it's just a different... We all know Metroid Other M got delayed, and that seems to have been for developmental reasons, and then they thought, oh, we might actually give Sinner's Punishment 2 a bit more room to breathe and space it all out. So that was a kind of casualty in America of Other M's development issues.
Yeah, well, we don't want Mario Galaxy 2 and Sin and Punishment 2 to compete for the same dollars.
Yeah, well, they're so
here.
Similar. I mean, we are very much talking about cannibalization at that point. So, yeah, I did want to bring this up, just a couple of things. First of all, I noticed doing a little bit of research while writing my review for it on the site, the import version, of course, that the high score tables are going to be shared between the US and Europe, but separate from the ones that already exist for Japan.
I wonder if that means they've changed something.
Exactly, yeah. That's what I was thinking. Is the game significantly different, and therefore the scores wouldn't be fairly comparable anymore, and that's why they've done it? I think that's quite interesting. God knows if there's anyone out there that will actually go to the effort to discern these differences.
Well, they've had plenty of time to tweak it.
Maybe it's easier?
Who knows?
I wouldn't be surprised if it's just an issue of... It's been out in Japan for so long. Maybe they just wanted to give Europe and America a chance to build their own scores.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Like, that sounds reasonable. Not have this already sort of built-up cache of amazing scores that you can't possibly kind of reach. I mean, yeah, it would be on a separate kind of world board, I guess, but maybe they think even that might be a bit scary for people.
But then again, I mean, the kind of people who are really interested in competing on online score tables probably want those Japanese scores as a basis of reference, don't they?
This is Nintendo, though. High scores.
No, but I'm saying
people.
For the fans, as far as what the fans would want.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the fans would have any problem, especially if you could like look at US and then go to worldwide, you know, as a separate board. But yeah. I guess we'll have to wait and see if there's a particular reason for that.
So they've added 5 extra levels.
I strongly doubt that. Oh, someone detected.
Removed 2 levels.
Someone detected, I think, at one point from a trailer that the colour of the sky had been changed in one point. I don't know whether that really affects your ability to score.
Well, it could be some psychological effect.
Possibly. But the last thing I want to mention about it, for anyone who is picking it up in Europe, this with the brave few that probably will, is that I would very much advise, having gone back to the game in preparation for writing the review, because I had some time, certainly putting more time into the score side of it rather than I beat it on hard and all that stuff before. It is worth beating the game with both characters because there's an unlockable there which really became the way I played the game. I'm not going to sort of spoil what it is.
Luigi.
It's not Luigi.
It's Luigi.
That would be shocking.
Spoiler alert.
But Greg, you're saying it's something non-cosmetic.
It is non-cosmetic. It will basically, for me, it really opened up score play. Because of the way it changes the game. That's when I really actually started setting some significant high scores.
Is this something that would give you the edge in the score tables?
No, because it has separate tables.
Oh.
Is it a golden plastic wheel?
I was thinking it was a power glove, actually, but...
Is this an animal, a mineral, or a vegetable?
20 questions. I mean, it's,
alive or dead.
You have separate tables, but it's just, for me, it just made score play more inviting. And then once you start getting into it, you get drawn in and you want to see if you can get any higher. I mean, I think I can get sort of broadly per level within the top 200, 150. Which is probably not that much of an honor, given how many people bought the game.
But Greg's actually in last place.
But the top scores are like
you know, 3 or 4 times higher than mine. I mean, it's just a whole other world of scariness.
Yeah.
But it's still fun to see how you can get, you can, just by applying what you learn, do a lot better, because the scoring system is very clever.
Okay. And James, you are wrapping it up, dog.
Yeah, so in order to keep things concise, I'm going to go with shitty review game that I already said basically everything I want to say about by telling you it's a shitty review game. But that's ATV Quad Kings for the DS.
Yes.
Which didn't do me the dignity of being bad enough that I can rag on it for 30 minutes. Instead, they just basically did the bare minimum effort when they ported it from a cell phone to the DS. It's horrible. I mean, let's just say that. I played one race of this game and immediately said, wow, I've seen everything this game has to offer. And after playing about 8 more races, I was like, nope. Still haven't seen anything new. By the end of it, I'm like, this fucking is terrible. Basically, it's your standard racing game where the controls don't quite work, the cars don't handle like they should, or ATVs in this case.
See, and you have to understand that James is really, his best reviews come when he either really likes a game or really, really hates it.
That's everybody, though.
Well, no, the thing is with James, though...
My middle ground is awful.
His middle ground is brutal to edit. There's one particular review, I forget what it was, but he was just like... This game is neither bad nor good. It's just kind of there. And it's like, how do I edit that as a reviews editor? I'm like, come on.
Well, that's the problem with this particular game is that it does nothing to distinguish itself. It is literally the most bland game I've played in like 3 years.
I mean, that's a fair thing to say in a review.
I mean, it's not good. It's not soul-crushingly bad. It's just...
So it's boring, and boring is obviously not what you want in a video game.
Especially a game about racing. I mean...
Yeah.
ATVs are a little bit deadly, and you're like, nah, it's going to be boring and slow and just not fun and look bad. It's just...
So as a quick diversion, James, your favorite racing game ever. Go.
Favorite racing game ever? I'm not big on the genre, but I judge all DS racing games against the Speed Racer DS game, which... No, I'm serious. No, I gave that game...
You reviewed that.
I remember just who could score. Have expected that, really.
Well,
you would say Speed Racer.
It looks good, it was fast, it handled well, and it was exciting. This game does none of those things.
Yeah.
I was playing this on the big DS IXL, and I was playing over at somebody's house, and they could actually see it from across. Like, I was sitting in one chair, and they were sitting in the other, and they could see it. And they asked me what it was, and I said, well, you know, it's kind of like F-Zero. And they're like, really? How's that? I'm like, well, if you were blind, deaf... and just knew that somebody was playing a game, you might confuse it. The problem is, it does everything wrong about a racing game, but doesn't do it so bad that I can't just be like, well, it's the sequel to...
Rig Racer.
Yeah, it's not fundamentally broken. It just doesn't understand what makes racing games fun.
Okay.
And that's because, I mean, my biggest complaint is it's not fast and controls poorly.
Okay.
It's pretty significant complaint.
It doesn't feel like you're racing.
It doesn't. It feels like you're riding lawnmowers.
Oh, God.
The straight story, the game.
Yeah. Well, David Lynch reference. Nice. Okay. James, I know you don't want to talk about this game, and I'm going to grant your wish.
Thank you.
So we're going to take a break now. When we come back, it's time for Retroactive, and we'll be discussing Metroid 2 The Return of Samus. So stick around.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Okay, this week on NWR, the mailbag has returned. Carl Castaneda brings it back from the dead and starts us off with questions about Vitality Sensor, Wii Motion Plus, and other assorted insane accessories from Nintendo. And what's coming up at E3? Other insane accessories from Nintendo.
Awesome.
And we have kind of a double dip of Sin and Punishment 2 this week. First, we have impressions from Lauren Lewandowski. I believe that's her last name. Probably pronunciation.
She's the Sin.
She's been on the site over a year, and he's just now learning.
Yeah, she gives us her take as a shooter neophyte, is how she describes herself. So it's kind of her take on a hardcore game from a softcore gamer. And of course we have a review of Sin and Punishment 2 from our own Greg Leahy.
He's the punishment.
He really liked it, as you would expect. He says that it has deep and challenging gameplay that makes excellent use of the Wii Remote, and that it couldn't be done on any other platform.
Well, at least until the Move rocks our world.
That's right.
On the review front, Zach takes a look at Mega Man 10, which he says is more of what you love about Mega Man games, but that's not a bad thing. In fact, it's a great thing, and read his review to find out why Mega Man 10 is more appealing than ever. Meanwhile, Andy has reviewed both versions, Wii and DS, of Sushi Go Round, and has pretty much the same criticism for both titles, namely that it lacks depth. Find out what comparison he draws between the two versions by checking out his reviews.
Go figure, a game called Sushi Go Round lacks depth. Alright, Neil's feature, Extra Life, has now moved on to discuss his impressions of Shattered Memories as he plays it for the first time. You know, we discussed this before, it's a stream of consciousness feature where he actually plays the game and makes these notes about what he's seeing and his feelings on it from a quick playthrough of a game that he missed the first time it came around.
And that's quite an interesting way to tackle Silent Hill Shattered Memories, actually. I think it's a nice pairing of feature to game in that case.
And Lauren makes a return for our now playing with her impressions of Picross 3D, which she apparently has found extremely addictive.
She is correct.
You'll find out why if you read her impression.
Picross crosses the blood-brain barrier, everyone.
Pick crack.
And before we go, I want to say make sure you check out the latest episode of Radio Trivia, where Michael TYP Cole and recent RFN sub James Charlton play music from 5 games, including, I'm going to spoil just a bit here, including the classic Contra 3 for Super NES. So see if you can pick that one out of the lineup and enjoy lots more game music and discussion by downloading Radio Trivia from NintendoWorldReport.com or iTunes.
I'll give you a clue. It's the one that sounds a hell of a lot like Alan Silvestri's score for Predator. Awesome.
All right. There you go. All right, we are back for Retroactive. This is number 12, I think. And we're talking about Metroid 2 Return of Samus for the Game Boy, which was the winner in our poll. We actually have a special guest joining us for this segment, Zach Miller.
Hi, everybody.
That's the favorite, that's the favorite entrance quote lately.
Just pops into your head.
Yeah.
Like the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
There you go. Oh, yeah.
You may know Zach as the co-host of NWR Newscast, so you can hear him every 2 weeks, and this week as well on RFN. And Zach, we got you on here because you're a huge fan of Metroid 2, right?
I love Metroid in general, and 2 in particular.
What in particular? Is this like one of your favorites of the series?
Well, No.
Most people wouldn't say that, is the reason I ask.
It's not my favorite, but I appreciate it for its context.
Mm-hmm. Good answer. And Greg, what about you? Have you played Metroid 2 before?
This was the first time I've played. I secured a copy last year when it was literally on a poll or it was talked about, and I just started looking on eBay sort of diligence. And I got a remarkably good deal on a very good conditioned copy, still in the box with the manual and everything. And then I played about a third of the game at that time, a year ago, and then I came back to it now for this and played it through to completion in a somewhat circuitous manner that we will return to, I think, later on in the discussion.
Okay. Well, it is one of the good things about us doing Metroid 2 is that it is one of the easier Game Boy games to track down, even though it is 20 years old. But it was a very common game back in the early 90s, and then around the mid-90s, it made Player's Choice, and so it was reprinted again.
Oh, that's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And my copy is Player's Choice, but it's up in my parents' attic, and so I ended up playing this on an emulator, and I'm not going to shy away from that, because kind of go back to the old argument we used to use, that it was okay to have a ROM of a game if you also own the physical copy. There's some backup clause that people used to rely on. I don't know if that really holds water, but I have paid for and played through Metroid 2 on a cartridge before, so rather than ask my mom to dig through the attic and ship me a little tiny cartridge just for the purposes of this, I just bit into an emulator, and it had, I'll probably get back to this later, but playing with a keyboard, not the greatest way to do it.
No, it's really not the greatest way to experience it. I, too, am playing through the wonders of technology.
Mm-hmm. And, John, was this your first experience with Metroid 2?
Yeah, it's interesting. This is one of those, this is kind of, for me, like Super Mario Bros. 3, where I loved, of course, the game before it.
You love Super Mario Bros. 2?
Yeah, I actually did. I loved that game when it came out.
I love it, too.
And I still love it. And I love the game after it, of course. You know, I love Super Mario World, one of my favorite games of all time. But it was like a big hole, so I didn't get to see the in-between stage. It was interesting. It's sort of like, this is the missing link in the Metroid series for me. So it was very interesting to see it and just be like, oh my god, so that was in the series prior to Super Metroid.
This is the Australopithecus of the Metroid series.
Indeed.
That's one of the main reasons I included it in the poll, is that, I mean, it is probably the most well-known game that was in the poll, and I understand some people might think that it was kind of the selections were slanted in favor.
Oh no, they were actually. It's not an understand.
I'm not going to argue with you. I mean, I did think that some of the other games had a chance to win, and Wario Land 3 very nearly did at one point.
Yeah, but you have to remember there was an active movement of, well, I don't want to play Metroid. Let's vote for the biggest game beyond it.
Yeah, fair enough. I think it was arguable which one was the biggest game. Pokemon Pinball was at one time declared the fastest selling video game of all time. So I don't necessarily think there was a clear favorite or even a clear second here, but I was okay with Metroid 2 winning, because not that it's necessarily one of my favorite games, but because I do think it's one of those that people have heard of, but a lot of people haven't actually played, partly because it is so old, and also, as we've talked about before, it's never been remade or re-released in any form, so the only way to play it legally, or in the highest fidelity, is to actually get an original Game Boy cartridge. And before we move on to the next topic, James, I just want to check and see, was this your first time with it?
My first time playing it more than just, like, limited experiences.
Mm-hmm. And as, you know, as we can probably tell, you're not the biggest fan of it.
No, not at all.
Okay. And we'll get into the details of why that is in a minute, but I did want to kind of go around and get a starting point for everybody on the panel here. So my first question is, how do you think Metroid 2 works as a portable Game Boy title, and does it feel like a full Metroid game? And I think we had a question last week in listener mail about numbered sequels to established franchises going to portables like Dragon Quest IX. And, you know, I didn't think to mention Metroid 2 at the time, but it's probably the original example of that happening. But, I mean, how do you feel, you know, was it a good idea to put the sequel to Metroid on Game Boy, and did it work out?
Well, good idea from what perspective? From the perspective of the game player or from the perspective of the company? I mean, I think it achieved the gamer.
I'm not worried about whether it was good for Nintendo. I don't care.
Oh, but I mean, you could argue it was good for the franchise too. I mean,
good for the game, good for the player.
I don't know. I mean, I just think it just seems like it wasn't exposed as much. I mean, it says something when I've played every other Metroid game except this one.
Mm-hmm. John has multiple complete save files of Metroid Prime Pinball.
Yes.
Well, I wonder if Metroid 2 being on the Game Boy had to do with propping up the system?
Might have.
Like trying to create a marquee
title. Well, I think the most obvious connection that people will make between the Game Boy and Metroid is Gunpei Yokoi, who is the producer of Metroid 2, But it isn't quite that simple from the point of view that the creative forces behind the original Metroid and Super Metroid are not the people responsible for Metroid 2, other than Yokoi at the most sort of executive level.
Right.
Because it's mostly the product, I think, of Intelligent Systems, who worked on the programming for Super Metroid, but not really on the creative side. Hmm. So you have that link there with Yokoi, and of course he created the Game Boy, R&D1, his studio there. They did a lot of very key titles like Super Mario Land and stuff. So I suppose if they were busy doing that, then Yokoi perhaps delegated a Metroid game, one of his other sort of babies, to Intelligent Systems. So I think that may well have been a big driving force, and certainly, you know, they weren't ready to make the jump to all the demands of Super NES development at that time in 1991. Mm-hmm. I think we can be confident of that. But at the same time, yeah, perhaps they felt that, you know, the NES was getting a bit sort of played out at that point. So I think you could see how it happened. Now, in terms of what the effect that it has on the game design, there's some curious sort of back and forth that I feel of where they kind of make some adroit moves to kind of rein the ambition in, because you've got to be realistic about what you can do on an 8-bit handheld with that kind of resolution and all this sort of stuff, and the fact that it is portable and people aren't going to necessarily play it in the same way as they would a console game. And on the other hand, there is overextension. I think primarily in the area of, you know, you've got these big, you know, quite attractive looking sprites for, you know, such a painfully primitive graphical hardware as it was at the time. You compare it with some of the earlier GB titles. It looks great. It's screenshots.
Sure.
It looks terrific.
It does.
I do think at the time it was the best looking Game Boy game.
Well, that's like saying it was the best looking ugly person. I mean,
yeah, but I do think they were pushing the hardware with Metroid 2.
But
the
problem
time.
With that is that you've got these big sprites that gives you this very cramped play area.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
The sprites are really big.
Yeah.
I mean, and what that does is it really affects a lot of things in the gameplay. Certainly when you're navigating the platforms to, you know, trying to sort of just get around the map.
Figure out where you are.
That's a different issue. That's a whole different issue.
Well, there's an issue of the sameness of the graphics in general, but because you get such a tiny snapshot at one time, it's even more difficult to differentiate them. Mm-hmm. So that's another example. And also, in the fights with the Metroids, which of course form the, you know, the real spine of the game, is killing all these Metroids, you very often find that as you try and sort of avoid an attack, they'll actually go off screen, which kind of temporarily terminates the fight altogether.
Right.
And then you have to run back towards them, sort of reactivate it and start hitting them again.
That's also an artifact from the first Metroid. So, Greg, you're on a roll here, and I want to make a couple quick responses before we move on and let everybody else speak. First, as far as the credits, as far as the people who are involved, last night I beat Metroid 2 for the first time ever. I'd never been able to actually beat the Queen Metroid before last night. And I was surprised by the credits, because the first name you see is Gunpei Yokoi, who I didn't really associate with Metroid. I knew he had something to do with the first one.
No, it's his baby. I mean, he's Game Boy, then Metroid. I mean, that's kind of, his
credits. I'm surprised to hear you say that. I mean, obviously, like, is it Sakamoto more so on the directorial side? But
well, that's a name I didn't see.
Exactly.
Sakamoto, not involved at all with Metroid 2, which might be part of the reason it's never been remade.
I think they were planning a DX style re-release at one point that didn't happen. So it's come close, you know, on Game Boy Color. But it didn't happen. But what's interesting about that is the fact that so many ideas in it did get integrated into Super Metroid, which was all Sakamoto.
Yeah, I have to think he at least respects Metroid 2.
Well, first of all, I suppose for people who are, you know, care about the stories of Metroid, the fact that he took the finale as the starting point for Super Metroid in itself, but it goes deeper than that in terms of some of the gameplay stuff, the art stuff. There's a lot in there.
Huge influence on Super Metroid.
And Metroid Fusion.
Oh, yes, certainly. Yeah. But I think what I'm trying to say with this whole issue of, you know, the overextension, you know, on the one hand, yes, it is linear. Yes, it is not. There is nowhere near the same kind of retraversal involved in it as, you know, subsequent Metroid games, or perhaps even the first one, although I've never quite brought myself to play through that for all that long to really verify that, which, you know, comes to the point that I haven't finished the game like you, Johnny, I found Metroid 2 to be immensely more playable, which is, I think, absolutely crucial. But
by far,
you can still feel it banging its head on the against the wall of the fact that this is a Game Boy game.
Well, I mean, the biggest problem with that is the Game Boy effectively is an 8-bit system, just like the NES is, mm-hmm. but it doesn't have any color, which in this game is a big pain in the ass.
Yeah,
that's why the Various suit looks so much different from a sprite perspective, because they had to differentiate it.
They had to redraw it.
Not even that, but just things like tunnels in the wall. I mean, in other Metroid games, they're a little bit discolored, so you can kind of see. Maybe I should try putting a bomb here. In this game, they basically look the same as everything else. So it's basically just roll against every wall and see if you get sucked into it.
Yeah, you're completely going blind most of the time.
Which is funny, because there's other reasons you're going blind in this game, too.
Well, yeah, I mean, James, if you go back to the original Metroid, what you're talking about, you know, secret passages in the walls, they worked the same that they do in Metroid 2.
They look exactly the same,
you just had to test it. And it wasn't until Super Metroid where they started to give you a little more of a clue, and then eventually the ultimate clue with the X-ray scope.
I feel like, though, it would still, not even necessarily just the tunnels, but having color would make it easier to tell what the hell's going on.
It's really differentiating the environment, so double whammy, because of the low-res nature of the graphics, or as long as if you could put a tremendous amount of detail to differentiate the graphics, you haven't got a big field of view to help you differentiate the graphics, and there isn't any color to differentiate the graphics.
Well, they do try to vary up the art style of the environments, and the environments are much more varied than they are in the first game, but they're not varied enough to make up for the lack of color.
I mean, they are trying at times. I think it's quite evident.
I almost feel like it would have been wise of them to go a less detailed kind of art style.
I don't know if you could get less detailed.
You could have gotten less detailed for the environments. I've played plenty of NES games that had less texture detail on the surfaces than this game.
But again, they had color.
Well, still, I
played plenty of Game Boy games with a lot less detail than Metroid
2. I think sometimes that there was so much detail on the stuff that it was kind of like, well, there's lots of black lines on white surfaces. I mean, what am I looking at? Mm-hmm. Versus if they just maybe used more solid structures, you could say, well, there's something here I need to pay more attention to.
Well, you can tell. I mean, a lot of the rooms do have, you know, particular looks to them. Like right at the start, you're going through that one area where you have all of the blocks that you can shoot out. If you look at that on the larger map, if you get the map off of GameFAQs,
that's right.
You can tell. I mean, if you look at the overall world map, all of the areas look very different, just from kind of like that 10,000-foot view. So they did do that, but the thing is, you're so zoomed in all the time. Most of the time, you can't see the bigger picture.
And one of the odd things about Metroid 2 is that it has a number of truly expansive chambers. I mean, for the it has rooms and caverns that would be large for any Metroid game.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Big empty chambers, too.
Yes.
Yes, very much.
They exist for you to spider-ball around.
Yeah, they exist to spider-ball around for 5 minutes, and they go, there's nothing in here!
Well, it's definitely a very marked increase in that once you get the space jump. I mean, the levels go crazy. You will have your vertical shafts with very little to get a foothold in.
Right.
So it is just, you got the space jump now. You can just keep going and going and going. And I mean, you can do that. It's not particularly entertaining.
Well,
this goes to a point that I wanted to make earlier, which is that I do want to defend Metroid 2 on technical terms in that it's working with obviously more limited hardware than the first game. And yet the art looks better overall. I mean, just in every way. Even without color, the art is better in Metroid 2.
There is a certain advantage in doing art on the Game Boy versus the NES, which is that it's smaller and it looks more detailed when it's down there like that.
But beyond that, it runs way the fuck better. Because, I mean, we all know that Metroid on NES is a janky mess. It is not programmed well.
Unplayable today.
It's made of shit. I mean, design-wise, it has many, many good qualities.
You're trying to get on the back of the box of the next Metroid game, aren't you, Johnny?
No, I'm just saying, like, the original Metroid, it really runs poorly. Like, you walk into a room, you've got discolored tiles, things are blinking as they go around. It's a mess.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of bugs and infinite loops. You can crash Metroid 20 different ways. It's a mess.
Sounds more appealing that way.
Metroid 2 is rock solid. And beyond that, one thing that I thought about as I was playing this, as I was going through these huge caverns, you know, and space jumping all over the place, is that the original Metroid, you know, it's famous for having these long vertical shafts, and then sometimes it has these long horizontal corridors. But it does not have a single room where you can scroll up and sideways together.
Yeah, that's true.
It's really a very one-dimensional game. You're always going straight across or up and down. And Metroid 2, even though it's on the Game Boy, and it must have been a bitch to program, it has these large rooms, and really as a necessity, because the field of view is so small, it has to be able to scroll smoothly in all two dimensions. Yeah, and so they kind of rejiggered the whole philosophy of map design around that. And so you, not only do you have these corridors that can scroll side to side and up and down to accommodate the fact that you can't see all of it at the same time, but they started to open it up into these really large rooms. And one more point I want to make about it is that I will defend these cavernous map designs in the sense that you are on a different planet, and it's supposed to feel like a more naturalistic environment, because this is a planet that hasn't really been, I mean, obviously, because it's the home planet of the Metroids, I mean, there are some Chozo statues, there's some save points, but beyond that, there's a lot less evidence of there having been a civilization there or some kind of military base, which is, you know, on Zebes or Zebes or however you want to say it, there's a lot more archaeology in Metroid and Super Metroid, whereas Metroid 2 is meant to feel more like you're in the jungle, basically.
Yeah.
You're on their home turf, and everything looks more alien.
And I think it succeeds in doing that.
It still does. It's still just these vacant spaces, which, like I said, it's really come to sort of dominate the game once you have the space jump and screw attack later on. You know, too much. They did without them, sort of fair enough for a significant part of the game, because you couldn't indulge it quite there. You spider ball, sure, but you know, it wasn't as prevalent. I felt to some extent it became more of a chore to navigate the environments later on in the game because of that, which is counter to the prevailing sort of direction of travel in Metroid games, which is it gets easier to traverse the environments because you are becoming more powerful. But because they just impose these vast caverns on you as soon as you had the ability to traverse them, it kind of made the process sort of less pleasurable.
Well, and the problem that comes with that is you don't know if you need to go explore every cranny of this big empty space, and then when you finish and realize, no, you didn't.
Yeah.
It's really, really frustrating. It's like, well, that was the biggest waste of time they could have ever put me in for no reason other than to do it.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because, you know, playing the game, it's like you, like when I was going through it, it's sort of, there were certain things I kind of expected because I've played like so much of the Metroidvania games. Like when I come into a big open chamber, I expect a boss battle, but I didn't always get that. And I expect,
in fact,
I always
usually didn't.
Yeah, it's like and I also always expect to be able to, you know, go into a room if there's like some little nook or cranny
and find a missile expansion.
Yeah, but there was a couple of those. There's a couple of those, but not to the extent that I thought there would be.
Actually, about the missile expansions, because I noticed this early in the game especially.
They look like torpedoes.
Well not that. It's there's a section near the start of the game where there's a room with basically three missile expansions in the same room.
Yeah, and then, all in a row, all next to each other.
And then if you go up a few floors, there's a room with two right next to each other. What the hell happened there?
Well, you have to remember that in order to progress in this game, you have to have a lot of missiles because you are killing Metroids, and that's the only way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you know, you notice that's near the beginning of the game, and after that, they spread them out, and they're harder to find.
It just seems like maybe you could have started them off with more missiles, maybe, rather than just say, here, take a bunch of them.
I just remember walking in the room and going, what the hell?
Yeah,
it's odd.
You don't see that very often in any of the other Metroid games, that's for sure.
You know, in every Metroid game and every Mega Man game, the hero has to forget all the powers he just collected.
That's right, but in this game, it's like, here's a bunch of them.
Yeah, but in this game, Samus has actually learned a few things since the first one. She can crouch, she can roll into the ball right from the beginning.
Yep.
It actually reminds me a little bit of, like, Corruption, where she kind of starts with the basics, at least.
Yep.
She has the long
I think the
beam.
Biggest thing is being able to shoot up and down. I mean, that's huge relative to the original Metroid. I mean, of course, I mean, again, because you're dealing with this confined kind of play area, it's all the more essential to be able to kill enemies. And certainly, say, for instance, if you're descending down a shaft before you've got the screw attack.
Oh, and you don't know what's below you.
You've got to shoot down because you're going to assume there's going to be something you can't see.
Because there's no chance you'll be able to see it before you're already dead.
It's absolutely essential that you have some of those extra things, but they are there, and that definitely was a big part for me and why it's more playable than the original.
Actually, about those kinds of, not necessarily specifically those kinds of enemies that are off screen, but the enemies in general, is it just me, or do you take a lot of damage and not get a lot of health for the healing items relative to each other?
Yeah.
I don't think any more so than Metroid.
Yeah.
The original is pretty brutal, too.
Yeah, well, that's it. Yes, I mean, compared to like Super Metroid, there's loads of areas where you get like what I would call enemy fountains, where they just keep coming out, and it makes it really easy to get back your health and stuff. But I was having a period in the game, not literally. I'm not a woman, and it was actually quite.
It was Samus is.
During this time, it was quite difficult for me to progress through the game. This was after I'd picked it up, after this big gap between last year and this year. And so I was going along, and it's like, God, these Metroids, they're taking me right down to the knob. I'm going to have to backtrack, find a recharge point, and then come back and kill the rest of them. And I thought, God, if this is the way the game's balanced, they really need to have more of these recharge points, because they don't have many. And of course, it introduces a save system, but it's not, regenerate your health abyssal save points. It's literally just, save with what you've got.
It's basically a save state.
And so at that point, I was thinking, this is getting ridiculous, it doesn't seem like it's set up for backtracking in this way. It's so linear. There's something wrong here. And I realized I was more than two-thirds through the game, and I didn't have the variasuit. And I was like, I should have it by now. What had happened is that, it was the kind of at that period of the game where I'd taken the big gap. And what it does with the variasuit is there's this fake out where you've got a Chozo statue with an empty hand. And then it's hidden behind it. And of course, in the gap, I just thought I'd collected that.
It's because you'd stopped playing for a while.
Yeah, for ages, and then I'd gone on and on and on, and then all of a sudden I had this and eventually I went back and found it, and I mean, that radically changes how tough the game feels, because you do take significantly less damage. And she also seems to walk faster.
That's a welcome change, because she does walk pretty slow.
She puts her arms up and moves them side to side when she runs.
Yeah, sort of a power walking kind of thing. I don't know what
it is. It's a metal stick with a rubber tip on the bottom that helps her push off.
But I mean, that's quite a weird thing there, because, obviously that's the thing with the variasuit in the other games, is always tied to specific environmental factors like the heat or the acid or whatever. That could never happen. Regardless of whether you were taking a gap.
How would they depict an area as hot on this game? I mean...
And there is the issue of water, where it kind of looks like the lava. For a while I got stuck because I didn't realize that was supposed to be water, which is
safe. Got an upgrade there that's not literally indispensable, but it is extremely useful.
I would actually say it is almost borderline indispensable, because even the basic enemies hit you for way more damage than the health they're going to drop.
I mean, the health drops are pretty small. I mean, it's true. There's a few of the larger enemies later on that will drop bigger health when you kill them, but they are quite few and far between. There's not a whole lot of enemies in general.
But when you find an enemy that drops a 20 energy, you will remember where it is. So actually, Greg, what you said gets to another observation I had, which is that even though Metroid 2 is considered the most linear game in the series, I think Metroid Fusion might give it a run for its money, but it's in a different way. And then it opens up a lot at the end, and all the sections start to connect together. Metroid 2 is very much point A to point B in a lot of cases. But what's interesting about it is, despite that linearity or that apparent linearity, it's probably the one that you can sequence break the most, or at least not sequence break, but it has probably the most chances for like a minimum percentage run, which a lot of people like to do in Metroid. because there are very few upgrades in the game that you have to get.
Yeah.
Bomb, spider ball, and space jump is probably about it. And all the beam weapons and everything else is optional.
Because, of course, that is the real core of it. The progression structure is fundamentally different from the other games in that it's primarily a matter of clearing a certain amount of Metroids, which it indicates on the sort of the pause screen, doesn't it? Like,
it's on the bottom right-hand corner, isn't it?
No, but what it is that when you pause it, it changes from the number of total Metroids left to the number of Metroids left before the next earthquake that drains the acid that lets you go deeper.
I didn't even realize that.
It is transparent in that way. It is telling you.
Just a quick aside, though. I like that the entirety of the exposition is a little icon in the bottom right-hand corner with a number next to it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Metroid is not about exposition in any of the games until
it
recently.
It is critically bad in this game.
Well, actually, I kind of like the countdown because it's weird. I think if they ever do a remake of this, it should be called Metroid Extinction, because you do realize at some point that you are there to kill all the fucking Metroids, every last one. And it's kind of, I don't know,
can't think of any
violent
other games that involve genocide quite like
that. No, not quite so vividly.
You are wiping out that race. And then the fact that, and I think especially as that number gets lower and lower and lower, you realize the magnitude of what's going on here, and you realize, like, there is one Metroid left in the universe, and you're about to kill it, and that makes the ending that much more poignant, because, of course, you kill the Queen Metroid, and then you find the Hatchling, and that is now the only Metroid left in the universe, and it likes you. That is a huge part of course, the whole story arc of the entire franchise. So, I mean, as little story as there is, I actually think it's really effective in its own way.
I guess that was probably them, you know, maybe, obviously, it was a different creative team, but that was them maybe kind of looking for another twist, you know, for Metroid, you know, famous for its quote-unquote twist of the female protagonist. I think this one's actually far more interesting, that, you know, you actually, in the end, after this bloodbath, this massacre, take pity on the little guy, and then of course they made it pay off a lot better with the third one.
Well, can you imagine in Aliens if Ripley at the very end kills the queen and then basically takes on her last little baby alien as a pet?
Yeah, that would be a little weird when you turn it around like that. I don't know.
Yeah,
I just love that Metroid 2 pulls it off.
I mean, one of the disappointments for me is just that there isn't, you know, more variety in those Metroid fights. They don't really evolve a great deal.
They really just float around.
They take a great deal more shooting. I think you get up to about 30 or something, 30 missiles you got to stick in some of these guys once you get to Zeta and Omega.
Where I think there is some variety in the boss battles, and actually, let me read a couple of forum quotes here about the boss battles, about the Metroids.
There's really only one boss battle.
there's one boss battle and a bunch of annoying Metroids that float around like jackasses.
Mini bosses, yeah. I mean, there is the Spring Ball Guardian thing. I actually quite like that.
Yeah, I like that one too. So, anyway, EJamer, posted in the forum thread, said, making the game actually focus on Metroids and their life cycle instead of hunting space pirates was interesting and added a lot of lore to the Metroid universe. And not explicitly about the boss battles themselves, but, and then as a counterpoint, Killer Manjaro posted about it and said, one of my favorite features of the Metroid series is the exciting, interesting boss battle. Super Metroid, and especially Prime Trilogy, had many memorable boss encounters where you made thoughtful use of new powers and adapted to shifting attack patterns. This game, on the other hand, can only offer those pitiful Metroid fights. As well as being pathetically easy, the fights were dull as dishwater, just ram and fire button until it dies. Even the Queen was as boring as the old Ridley and Kraid fights. Now, what do you all think about that? I mean, do you like these kind of new mutations of Metroids? Do they work for you as boss battles, or are they just kind of minor encounters?
Just not varied enough. You know, most of the time it's about kind of, you know, making sure, like I said, I mean, some of the problem is the way the whole play area thing factors into it.
Yes.
But also just the fact it's always about keeping them off with your missiles. Just, you know, if you can keep pounding them and sort of early on, you can attack them from below. So that's the easiest way. And that's pretty much the most substantive change in them, is that later on, once you get to like the Zeta and Omega ones, you have to attack them from the side.
And you have to be very specific about it.
Yeah, so it's a bit, so they do get trickier, but it is very much the same thing, which is just pound them with missiles, pound them with missiles. And, you know, they don't really have, you know, intricate attack patterns or anything like that that you might expect from. So certainly, I mean, Fusion, I always thought, had a really strong array of interesting bosses, kind of underrated in that regard.
Mm, yeah. Well, that's
The spring boss from Fusion is the same as the one from Metroid 2.
yeah, that guy. Like I said, I like that, but that's too rare, in my opinion. He could have used with a few of those. The Queen, on the other hand, I actually quite enjoyed.
Oh, me too.
I thought that was quite good, because it does have some variety in attack patterns when it lets out those sort of indestructible blobs that I just quickly did a tight screw attack. And then it's gone, and then you can get back to hitting it with the missiles. And of course, it has the alternative way of killing it that I heard about ages ago when I was reading about the game, you know, 10 years or more ago, back when I was reading up on, you know, the Metroid database when that was young, you know, and about that you can stun it with its mouth open and then climb inside with the morph ball and blow it up from the inside. And the thing about that, especially the way that it actually hurts you while you're inside it, they pretty much ripped that off for, was it Dragon or Dragoon in Super Metroid?
With the electricity.
Yeah, I mean, that is the same basic idea. You're doing something that kind of hurts you, but it hurts them a hell of a lot more, and it's a lot quicker than shooting missiles into it for 3 hours. Yeah.
So, James, what was your comment about the boss battle question?
I felt a lot of the Metroid fights either ended prematurely because either you got knocked off the screen or the Metroid just departed the building, essentially.
yeah, absolutely. And
which in many cases resets them, but your ass is still beat up.
You found that they ran away? I never had that happen.
Well, they just kind of stop. If they go off the screen, it's like
they just float away.
Yeah, they freeze. It's really weird.
You kind of had to just get in one spot and then let them pass over you and shoot. Like, they just weren't interesting. So most times it was like either, great, there's a Metroid shell, I don't have enough health. Damn it. I'll come back later. Or it was, all right, let's just get this crap over with.
Brute force it a lot of the time. You know, if you've got the health to do it, that's what you'll do. And that really isn't very interesting.
No, it's boring.
I think I must have played these battles a lot differently from you guys, because for me it's all about, I mean, obviously they have certain patterns and very crude kind of behavior programming. But I liked finding ways to exploit that. And I think the designers knew that that's kind of the way you had to approach it, is like, you know, get it barely off the screen or figure out what triggers it to fly through you and try to harm you. And so, you know, you can kind of avoid doing that. But also what I found interesting is that even though, you know, maybe there's a section where you end up fighting like 10 gamma Metroids in a row, and they all behave exactly the same. But what the game does to vary it up a little bit is it puts you in all these different kinds of environments. So sometimes you're in a big bank of sand that you have to shoot through with your other weapons in order to really have a shot at the Metroid. Sometimes you're in water. Sometimes there are spikes on the walls and on the ground, and you have to be real careful about where you move to. So I found that stuff kept it interesting enough. There's still some repetition, but they're not all the same.
I would have been happier if there were less Metroids, but more thought went into each of them. It feels many times like the fight's not really an event. It's just another fucking thing. I have to have enough health before I go into this room any further.
Yeah, so in other words, you want actual real bosses.
Yes, that's it. I want something that's a boss. Something that after I'm done, I'll remember it individually instead of saying, man, I killed a lot of that same Metroid.
Yeah.
I've always thought it's a great missed opportunity that they didn't do anything else, I mean, really, with the different mutations of Metroids in the other games in the series.
I agree. It's a cool idea.
The Omega Metroid shows up at the bitter end of Fusion as kind of an afterthought.
Yeah, that's a weird callback, because it really kind of comes out of nowhere. And
if you haven't played Metroid 2, you don't know what it is.
Right. It's a weird callback at the end of Fusion.
But I guess the biggest thing you could do if you were doing them again is make them substantively different. I mean, that's really what it's crying out for, you know, because they physically look quite different. And then, you know, if it actually translated to their behaviors and how you would defeat them.
Well, and I think if they were going to do that, like I said, they would have to have just less encounters.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because it is very... I mean, what we're kind of... I've kind of been talking about is the lack of diversity on the kind of macro scale, you know, in terms of, like, all the different variants, they're not very different. But because there's so many of these encounters, I mean, even if they were more different, you'd still go through patches of the game where, like Johnny said, you defeat 10 of the same guys in a row or whatever.
Right.
I guess the real issue is that they don't have much else to populate the game with.
Yeah, in many ways, but yeah. I know exactly what he's talking about, and in many ways that feels basically like they're just stronger normal enemies.
And part of it is that you are getting stronger as you go through the course of the game, whereas the enemies, you know, for each sequence where you're fighting mostly the same kind of Metroid for a while, they're not really getting stronger. But then they kind of have a step change.
Yeah.
And so now it kind of resets the balance a little bit, and they're very hard for a little while.
Of course, one of the weird things is that they're not, I mean, just pumping them full of missiles is not how you defeated the Metroids in the original, or how they've been presented pretty much ever since, which is sort of like freezing them first. But they reprise that in the final part of the game.
Right.
Where they just have a bunch of them hatch when you think you're down to the last one. And that was really interesting because that forces you to go back and get the ice beam.
Well, they actually planted an extra... I think there are 3 ice beams in the game.
So yeah, that's the thing, because here, rather than like having them stack or having a switch like you do in Super Metroid, you just go and get another one. I mean, there's one right next to the final part of the game, but it's right there waiting for you to go and get it. So I thought that was kind of weird, because I think the ice beam is one of the first things you get, and then you go through, you know, like Spacer and the plasma beam and all that, which you've seen better in many ways.
Right.
And sort of slow ice beam, but in the end you have to sort of get that back and then use that to kill the Metroids the old-fashioned way. And again, they are deadly in the limited play area because they get on top of you very quickly, but you don't have a lot of time to react because they're on screen, they're almost on your face. Like, you've got to be quick. And they're quite difficult to get off once they're on you.
I've always found the original Metroids to be a very menacing creature, considering that they've never really been presented as bosses. They don't have their own music. They don't have their own rooms.
Well, I mean, really, I mean, Metroid 2 and Super Metroid all have the same thing at the end, which is a bunch of freeze them, pump them with 5 missiles before you get to the last boss.
Well, that's the hallmark of the 2D games, is that at the end you fight a bunch of Metroids.
Metroid doesn't want to be fed, it wants to hunt.
Oh, God.
Nice.
Problem-solving intelligence.
One thing we haven't talked about much is the portability, and of course John and I both played on a computer, so...
I can pick up my computer, Johnny. I carried it around.
Yeah, well, mine is... I have a netbook, so it is small, but... I think it's interesting because certainly it was a big deal back when the game first came out. You know, it was great that it was on Game Boy because now, I mean, the first time I ever played it was on a school bus on a field trip. So there's something to be said about that. Kaitim98 posted, if the DSi or any future iteration of the handheld were to ever have a virtual console service or a virtual handheld service, Metroid 2 would be at the top of my list for having the game on the go. I mean, it takes the epicness and the sci-fi elements of the series and allows you to take it on the go. This game is a true progenitor for the GBA Metroid games. Now, I thought this was an interesting comment because I don't really feel like it's designed as a portable game to the standard that we would expect now.
It has those save points scattered around, which is nice.
But they're not nearly frequent enough.
No, and here's the other part of that, and we'll touch on this more later, is that you might not know where they are. Because there's no map.
Yeah, there's no map, so...
Right. And that,
so, that, in fact, that kills the portability because you have to have your map printouts with you everywhere you go.
Yep. All folded up in your pocket, yeah.
I didn't end up playing much of this portably. I tried playing it on my original GBA because that's the only thing only portable I can play old Game Boy games on, and I don't know how I played anything on that. It's so bad. I just can't believe it. I played it on the GB Play. It looks, you know, nice enough, but yeah, right. In terms of it being portable, I mean, like I said, they did a few things in terms of they did make the structure more simple. You didn't have to backtrack to nearly the same extent as you would in subsequent Metroid games.
Or in the original. I mean, the original has, Torian, the interest of Torian is very close to the beginning of the game.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's structurally quite different, but the difficulty of knowing where you are kind of makes that little bit of back and forth that you've got to do more difficult and less conducive to a portable game than would be ideal. And that's kind of the way I handled it with the map issue, was basically like I would look at a map once I'd triggered an earthquake. And then say, right, let's now I'm going to have to backtrack and find the next bit where the lava's gone down. And then from there, it's kind of like, okay, I'm in a new area. Let's just explore this area and kill Metroids until that counter on the pause goes to naught. And that was that was kind of the way I did. So I kind of balanced, you know, keeping some of the kind of mystery there. Because, of course, you know, in the Metroid games that have maps, you don't tend to have the whole map accessible to you. They'll have a certain amount that's laid out, and then you'll fill in the rest yourself, and then maybe you'll download something later on that fills everything in.
Right. We should probably mention here that Super Metroid basically invented the auto map. So it's not that they intentionally left a map out of Metroid 2 to be bastards or to make it more difficult. It wasn't even thought of back then.
But
I wish it had been.
Yeah, because it really needs it.
Yeah, I mean, they knew there wasn't going to be a map when they made the game.
They were very much aware of the need for it because you had the experience of Metroid and you had, you know, all the Nintendo Powers or whatever that had maps in there. And, you know, people were very quick to provide maps for the second one in magazines. Or I mean, they knew they needed it, but for whatever reason, it isn't in there.
If you didn't subscribe to Nintendo Power, basically we're screwed if you bought Metroid.
It might have been a size, I don't know how you'd say this, file size issue.
I do think there were probably technical problems with doing an auto map back then.
I mean, I guess, you know, the first one, people had their graph paper out if they weren't subscribing to Nintendo Power.
Yeah, and you know, people did that for games back then. I'm sure a lot of people had graph paper out for Metroid 2.
Yeah, I know. It just they had to have learned from the experience of Metroid that, wow, this game is pretty brutal without the map.
Right, well, yeah, but as I said, though, the game design is dialed back. It isn't as intricate. There isn't as much backtracking. It's not as unwieldy.
And it's generally more segmented. So the idea was, well, we know people are going to get lost, but they have at least less to keep up with at any given time because you are working within
It's almost divided into levels.
But see, this is where that smaller frame of vision becomes a problem because it's like orienteering when you can't see past your nose. I mean,
no, you're right.
You're absolutely right. That's why. So on the one hand, they're reining it in, but on the other hand, they're still overreaching.
Yeah,
it sums up why I'm feeling.
One hand giveth, and the other hand taketh away.
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. So, John, to go back to save points a little bit and maps, John, I don't know if you experienced this in the amount of time that you played Metroid 2, but I found that playing it on an emulator on my computer had a couple of nice advantages despite the drawback of
you could
using
make
the
it
keyboard.
Bigger.
Because I had GameFAQs at my fingertips with the map.
Yeah.
And also, I had save states.
Yep.
Because
yes.
I found that the save points were... And I've played through the game up to the final boss on my Game Boy. So I have played it. I have played through it relying on the save points they give you. But damn, it's... I think I would have had to do a lot more grinding and a lot more backtracking to save points... without just being able to load up a state.
I did more than that than I needed to because I didn't have the bloody various.
There you go.
I mean, I played it. The first thing I did was I made the screen twice as large, and
Good call.
I got the map off of GameFAQs, and I had that thing open on the desktop behind the window in which I was playing the game. And I just moved it around. As I played, I would move the window around to areas of the map where I was. Like, I would, like, uncover areas of the map, like, move the window around.
I played the game on my big 23... Well, I had the map on my big 23-inch screen monitor, so I could basically see it from anywhere in the room. And it was the official map that came out of Nintendo Power that actually labeled where everything was. And and it was actually almost hard to tell where you were on that map because... from your tiny little view of the screen, you're like, well, what piece of architecture is that?
Yeah.
So you basically just had to remember, okay, I'm near where I found the spider ball. Okay, so I'm right there.
Well, I'm glad I didn't spoil the game for you, James.
Oh.
You know, there's still some skill involved.
I've always liked those maps in Turok. They first did it in Turok, as far as I know, where you could open the map while you're playing the game.
Like and Turok are two phrases. Don't tend to go well together.
I know exactly what you mean, and it drew it as it went. But the weird thing is, in Turok, this is the first N64 game. It was a 2D map. you know, right. And it's almost, it looks almost hand-drawn.
Very basic.
Yeah, but that's a 3D game.
And that is, I was wondering how would one orienteer without being able to see past your nose? And, oh, I played Turok, so.
Yes, well, that's right.
That whole game was about not being able to see past your nose because of all the fog. Yeah. Quote-unquote fog.
The legendary fog.
So Turok is essentially the spiritual successor to Metroid 2.
It's the
version. It was a sort of, you know, him hunting an endangered species as well. So, I mean, yeah, the similarities are starting to add up.
Fuck them dinos. Well, to get back on topic, one of the last big things I want to talk about is the spider ball. And again, this is one of my observations every time I play through Metroid 2, is that this is a weird power-up, the spider ball. It debuted in Metroid 2, and then it disappeared until Metroid Prime.
In a much more limited form in Metroid Prime.
Thank God.
I think wisely limited in Metroid Prime. Very wisely, because it does present kind of a design problem here. I mean, it in some ways it sort of breaks the level design, but the game is designed knowing that it's kind of broken with the spider ball, and so they start to hide things, you know, in places where you have to use the spider ball to get to it. And I think the main complaint about it is that it's so slow.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. That's the
very
main problem.
Very,
and it's very,
very
easy to get knocked off by a bad guy.
Oh, yeah. God, yes.
And
also it gets directions mixed up, like, yeah, because obviously your directions change as you'll be going round. So then if you stop for a second, then it all, which is what would have, say for instance, if I wanted to lay bombs along something suspicious, but then I wanted to get out of the way of the bombs before they blew up and knocked me up, I would then actually go towards them by mistake.
Thank you, game. Well, it's like, why am I pressing right to go left? Well, because when you started 8.5 minutes ago on the other end of the chamber, that was the direction you were going.
Well, but, you know, Resident Evil, the original Resident Evil worked that way, too.
Look, no. You don't want to compare yourself to that game.
Yeah, just
I mean, look, I think controls-wise, the spider ball is handled very well. I mean, I think it's surprisingly well done in terms of, you know, because it's a hard thing. I mean, ask anybody who's played a Spider-Man game. It's hard to design a system that lets you crawl around on the walls. And I think Metroid 2 does it well in that respect. I do think they didn't really know what to do with it.
Yeah, it's cool. But, I mean, as I said, it's part of this weird kind of undercurrent to a lot of it where, that you know, Samus doesn't really have, you know, fewer abilities as she has in many other Metroid games. Mm-hmm. But their usefulness, their sort of feeling of being
exactly.
integral to the game is much less so.
The spider ball is like the spinner in Twilight Princess. It's really cool for like 10 minutes, and then you're like, I never want to use this again.
It's a key.
It's not a key. I mean, it's not. You can use it anywhere. And
I think near the various soup area, there's a bit where there's like a shaft that you could only get through crawling up it with the spider ball.
Yeah.
But like I said, the abilities, apart from the all-important space jump, as you kind of discuss, you know, just feel kind of divorced from the progression of the game.
I mean,
it's cool to kind of experiment with some of them, or the different beams, or, you know, this kind of thing to some extent, but they don't really have a greater applicability because of the level design. And I think that's really where it is so, so different from Super Metroid.
They could have cured it if they put in a whole lot more items to find.
Or if they made the items more situationally useful. I mean, to go with what Greg was saying, so when I started the game, you know, like I said, I'd only played it, you know, some store displays and other stuff back in, like, 1991 when I was 5.
Yeah.
But, I had, before I killed a single Metroid, the ice beam, the spider ball, and the bomb. I don't think I'd even seen a Metroid at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And a bunch of missile upgrades. It was like, well, that's great. Where the fuck am I going? Because I'd spent like an hour just wandering around the first few chambers going, I don't know what any of this is. And then you fight a Metroid. I'm like, well, okay. What's the spider ball for again? Why haven't I used the spider ball yet?
Well, I have a choice forum comment about spider ball. So Voodoo posted, I like the idea of the spider ball, but I don't think it's implemented very well in this game. There's several large caverns in the game that can take upwards of 5 minutes to circle using the spider ball. Most don't have anything worthwhile hidden in the walls or ceiling, but you still have to encompass the entire room just to make sure. It's a slow, tedious process that I could have done without. Now, we've covered some of the same ground already. I don't want to go back to it, but the question I asked in the forums, and I'll ask to you guys, because I think it's a good thought experiment. Do you think that the spider ball could ever return in a 2D Metroid? I mean, this is assuming there will be another new 2D Metroid. And if they do, or even thinking about a potential remake of Metroid 2, if they ever try this again in 2D, what could be done differently? Or is it maybe an idea better left on the cutting room floor?
Metal surfaces.
Yeah, I mean, they nailed it in Prime in 3D. You limit it. Now, the way you would limit it in 2D would be different. You know,
right.
But you would limit it to, you know, like Zach said, you could have like a visual kind of cue that it's something
right.
that can
be. Right,
you
have color, so you can make the wall look different.
But yeah, you could. Yeah, it looks like metallic or whatever, something that makes it look like you could stick to it. And then, you know, make it faster. Obviously,
that's
pretty important. And then maybe just like design, like what's good about the spider ball in Metroid Prime, what they did with it, and even, you know, some of the sequels as well have examples of this, where you've got some, you're pretty complicated level design in a sense, just going into those tracks,
puzzles almost.
Yeah, exactly. But you're boosting between portions of the track, and you know, maybe you have to do a bomb jump, get back on the track, drop off, then make sure you're holding
like,
it down so you
like
reattach.
Like Elysia in Corruption.
Yeah, that's got some good ones. So there's a bit in the icy bit of Brio that's got some good stuff there. They've written the playbook. I mean, they really have. It worked just as good in terms of basically what you could do is inject just some variety, essentially a very different brand of almost platforming. Into specific sections of the game, rather than this, you know, broad applicability which dilutes it to nothing.
Right. I think the other issue, if they were going to remake this game, and we've kind of touched on this different approach, but primarily you can't fall off if you've been hit one time. That's unacceptable. If it takes 5 minutes to get from one side to the other.
I agree, James.
Yes, absolutely. Because especially as we talked about some of these absolutely colossal rooms.
Yeah.
Once you start falling, it's over. And that also applies, you know, with the space jump and stuff as well. You know, once if you get, for some reason, you just kind of lose that momentum, you just fall like a stone.
Oh, and the other part, and this goes back to the map. If I have the map, I can see, there probably is a reason I need to go all the way up there. Versus, well, I don't see any chamber that could connect to that, so I'll pass on going up
think
there for
Think about the, probably you know, the most signature element of you know, the first Metroid is the idea that, you know, the way it introduces the morph ball in the first you know, screen of the game, practically.
Right. It teaches you that this is about upgrades.
The
right.
level design shows you, the, just with the design, shows you, okay, well, you know, I can't do it, but then I get this. And then I can get past this, and so that's what this is for.
Right.
Well, then, and also the morph ball in the original Metroid is to the left of your starting point, which would have been mind blowing when that game came out.
Yeah, it's
that,
like I went the other way,
right,
what?
And you can't. And then it forces the only thing left to do is to go left, which was pretty much not done.
Well, you know, it's funny is that in Metroid 2, I tried going left, and there's nothing there. there's a wall, and it's like nope.
That ends up being the return path in the final escape sequence.
Oh,
and
okay.
I think you could say some similar examples from Super Metroid as well, is that you know, you would be introduced to an ability in such a way, there wasn't a written tutorial, on-screen tutorial or anything like that, but with the design of the game, it's showing you this is what this upgrade is all about, this is what you can do now, and you don't really have that in Metroid 2. Is another part of the fact that it's just you know, so different from the others. Even though you've got some cool abilities and they're not built around, because the whole level design kind of paradigm is very bland in general.
Right.
You know, you think about the way, and you talked about Fusion. Fusion is often referred to as, you know, the other kind of linear Metroid. You know, you have these sort of discrete sections, you know, the six tanks in the space station and all that stuff. But in the end, it all starts to kind of crisscross and mesh, and it looks a lot more like the sort of interconnectedness of Super Metroid. And I think that's the problem with Metroid 2, is it never, at no times ever really come together at the end or anything like that. You know, it is just that straightforward.
That's true.
Well, before we wrap up the whole Spider-Ball thing, I do want to, contradict you guys a little bit in that I feel like limiting, I think the way it works in Prime is the only way to do it in 3D. It would be completely insane to let you go Spider-Ball anywhere.
It would be impossible to program effectively.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. It would be a disaster. So I think that's the only way to do it in 3D. In 2D, I think making it track limited or something, you know, analogous to that would be a mistake. Because, you know, I've talked to you guys before that, for instance, in Super Metroid, I think the grapple beam is really wasted. And it is in Prime as well. It's in all the Metroid games. The grapple beam is wasted because it's so limited to very specific attach points. In Retro, eventually, like in 3, they tried to make up for that by having it involved in combat, which is equally really kind of annoying and not
really
that
much fun. I'm going to steal your shield.
But I feel like the grapple beam is something that really has never been done justice in Metroid because it's so limited. And I understand why it has to be, and maybe that just means that, for me, they probably just shouldn't try to do the grapple beam.
Well, I mean, some of it with the grapple beam is basically an intermediate step before you get the space jump. You know,
right.
It's kind of like, okay, well, now you can traverse these specific bits easily. Later on, you're going to be able to traverse anything easily.
It's like getting the slingshot in Ocarina of Time. Well, enjoy until you get the bow and arrow, and then
you get the real deal. It's an intermediate step. I think the difference with you talking limited use Spider-Ball in Metroid Prime or in a hypothetical 2D game is you're actually be introducing some legitimate sort of gameplay variety in these little windows. But you know, the problem is that maybe give game designers a little more credit, but it just seems so difficult to develop a comprehensive system without running into some of the problems. No, it wouldn't have to be all. I'm sure he could do a much better job than he did in 2.
Yeah, but what's so great about Metroid and what it does better than almost any other game series out there is it gives you upgrades that feel so powerful when you get them, and it feels like, wow, I can use this anywhere. I mean, though I've said before many times, that's my favorite kind of upgrade, is the thing that is not super limited, very specific. It's something that you can integrate into the style of your playing.
Yeah.
And also fool around with a little bit too.
Yeah, you can
kind
play around
freestyle
with it
a little bit.
But, and you know, Screw Attack in Prime 2 and 3 is a great example of that. It just feels so crazy broken when you get it. But and then the speed boost, like in Super Metroid, is another great example. It feels like, wow, this is going to totally, I'm going to use this everywhere. And what you very quickly realize is that you can't really, you can technically use it anywhere, but you don't really want to.
Well, I mean, one thing I will say on that kind of subject, if you look at Zero Mission, the attention to detail with which they constructed so many parts of that game in terms of how long they gave you to have
of
a run-up.
The speed boost. It's insane.
Unbelievable. I wouldn't have thought that was possible.
Yes.
I wouldn't have thought that you could be that careful and that clever with the whole game, every flaw in the game in terms of, you know, some of the shine sparking stuff you could do to get special weapons and stuff like that. They've thought of it all. I wouldn't have necessarily thought that was possible. So on that basis, you know, maybe, like I said, you give them credit, maybe they could pull it off.
It's the most meticulous level design I've ever seen in any game.
I think, though, that in the case of Spider-Ball in particular, because it can go anywhere.
Okay, let me just note, it doesn't go over spikes.
All right, well, fine. It doesn't go over spikes. We have to put a hell of a lot of spikes out there to fix the problems that you can.
Well, maybe there are other things it can't go over. All I'm saying is, you can, I think, in a remake of Metroid 2 or in a new 2D Metroid game, you can put the spider ball in there and you can let the player use it whenever you want to without having to find a specific allowable zone, you know, a track that it's made for. But you can constrain it in some subtle ways, maybe more subtle than spikes, but I think
that's
it
not
can
really
be
all
constrained
that
in ways that make it work. And I also think, in terms of what Greg said about how well Retro implemented into platforming and puzzles, I think that is possible in 2D as well. It's not done in 2,
totally,
but it could be done.
I think the problem with these kinds of mechanics that allow the game to essentially move in both dimensions in an unlimited sense, it makes the level design that much more critical. And
what it's asking for is a level of rigor that is uncommon in games, first off. Mm-hmm. Second of all, is it worth the time and effort? That's the determination that the developers are going to make. And, you know, chances are they've looked at this for Fusion and stuff and said it isn't.
And I think Metroid 2, didn't give it the kind of rigor it probably needed. Because
no, it didn't. I mean, that I think that's inarguable.
The level design, I mean, it makes some of Sakurai level designs look nice in some cases.
I'm going to disagree
same time,
with you
I
there.
Think, I think we're forgetting that Metroid 2, in being kind of a missing link, it's a very experimental title.
Yes.
You know, they're trying a lot of new stuff out and seeing what sticks, and a lot of it did for Super Metroid, and I think we have to give it some credit for that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just felt like that it was one of the least fun items I've ever seen in a game.
No, I agree. It's very messy the way they did it, and it obviously hurts the game a lot for some people, and I understand that. But I do think the idea is not without merit. Moving on, the last thing I want to touch on before we wrap up this epic discussion is the sound. And we got this comment from Uncle Bob, one of our best and longest serving forum members, and Uncle Bob posted, "The music in this game is wonderful. I wish there was an option to turn off the sound effects and just let the background music and noises, the keyword, play. Great game, thanks for the excuse to play it again." Now, I think this is a good place to wrap up because it's certainly contentious and interesting. So I'd like to go around and kind of get each one of your thoughts on the soundtrack to Metroid 2. John.
There's a soundtrack?
Yeah. I mean,
your name's John?
It's just kind of weird because, I mean, like, my impression is that kind of from room to room, it switches up a lot. Like, in some places, it's kind of just ambient sounds, and then in other places, you actually have sort of, you know, actually conventional music-ish stuff.
Yeah, melody.
And it's just kind of weird because you'll come into a room, you'll be like, wait a minute, why is there all of a sudden...
Yeah, it's more of that boss battle conditioning. Uh-oh, here comes a Metroid boss battle. And
yeah.
Nope, never mind. Just another cavern.
Yeah, exactly. Again, I've played too many Metroidvania titles, and I expect something to happen when the music changes.
Oh,
it's just
that's
the way
it is.
That's
not even Metroidvania. That's just video games in general.
Yeah,
hey,
right.
The music changed. This room's different. Something must... No, nothing? Okay.
Well, nope. Metroid 2, as we've established, is not video games in general. I mean, I do think... actually, I love the soundtrack, and I don't want all the Metroid games to sound like this one, but I love what they're trying to do, and it goes back to Zach saying this is really experimental, but I feel like Metroid 2 is one of the only video games I can think of that actually goes into basically avant-garde soundtrack territory. It is so weird and fucked up. And I think it totally works because, again, it really enhances the feeling that you're on an alien world where maybe no one's ever been before. No one should ever go there, right? It's infested by these evil creatures. And it's just beyond your comprehension. And the music, to me, really pulls that together. And also, and you guys sort of alluded to this, it's so dramatic. Sometimes you walk into a room and it sounds like something crazy is about to happen, and maybe it doesn't. That's horror movie.
I don't think that's what they were going for, though.
I do, though. I think it's meant to be scary and disturbing.
It's not scary,
and off-putting.
Though. It's just silly.
Again, I think some of it is thinking about the limitations of the Game Boy hardware. You know, you're not going to be able to do atmosphere in the way that Super Metroid does it, with the lush instrumentation and, you know, the weaving different themes in and out and all this stuff. So it's like, how are you going to do it? And they go for the ambient direction in, you know, for most of it. I mean, there's some melody stuff, and that's not bad, actually.
I disagree, though, because the music should at least be as good as the NES music, because the Game Boy's music, Game Boy sound system, is better than the NES sound system.
Well, I don't think it's being held back by technical concerns. I think they wanted it to sound
What I'm saying is that if you're going more for atmosphere, like, you know, I think the thing with the original Metroid is, you know, its music's really classical. There's loads of sort of classic melodies and all that, but it's almost so kind of anthemic that it's not that atmospheric, you know what I mean? It's kind of very strong, but it's not really going to sort of create a kind of subtle kind of atmosphere. And I think if you wanted to do that, which they kind of did in Super Metroid, but as I said, you've got way more options then, because the Super NES hardware for sound was so good. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to go more that atmospheric direction on the Game Boy, how you're going to do it is this way, with this kind of ambient noise stuff. And I thought it was out of the box, because like you said, I mean, the easy thing is to just do 8-bit music again, like you did in the original. I mean, but I think they wanted to do something different, and it does work.
Yep.
It's not, like, very hummable, but, you know, the NES Metro stuff is eminently hummable.
Right. I think music's one of the best things about the original NES Metro.
It is. Yeah, no, totally.
The
timeless.
But they went in such a different direction here. But I still think it does work here for what they were trying to do with it. They're not so good for putting it in the Smash Brothers soundtrack.
I feel like the biggest problem with the music in this game is that there's so little going on a lot of times in the game. It just feels really empty. Because you have big caverns that may have a few enemies in them with walls that are pretty nondescript.
No, I take your point from the point of view a lot. When you think about a lot of ambient music that's being used in games, it typically tends to be juxtaposed with imagery that is, you're supposed to be evocative in itself.
Right. There needs to be something. The end result is something that's almost understimulating.
Well, now hold on a second. Now, you know, Johnny said that they're trying to create an ambient noise that nobody's been here before. I really think that in Metroid 2, they are kind of going for a, it's hard to say this, but living world. You know, if you go outside, if you look out your
but
window...
But there's nothing in it. It's
exactly.
Dead.
That's exactly dead. Right, though. If you go out in the woods and you look around, there's not an animal every 10 feet. It's mostly empty space. No, that's not true at all.
Not in Alaska, maybe, but here it is.
James, we don't all live in the woods.
Exactly. But what I'm saying is, in any given environment, there's not going to be an animal popping out in front of you every 5 feet, and I think maybe that's what they were kind of going for. There's a lot of empty rooms because it's a planet.
I mean, I think it's supposed to feel like you're walking through caves.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the whole Metroid, at least the early Metroid games. I mean, that's kind of what they were going for, like kind of the whole in space, no one can hear your scream kind of thing. Like you're supposed to be out on some crazy like space outpost where there's nothing there but you.
I just feel like at least with the NES game, there was color. I mean, there was stuff to
argue that the music is color itself, James.
It's not though, because there isn't any.
So I think the gist of James's view on Metroid 2 is should have been on NES.
Well, no. I think it would have been a better game on NES, definitely.
Well, I think the biggest blank that I've got in terms of the contextualizing this experience is the fact that I didn't have a Game Boy at that time, and I only played a select few games when friends, you know, would have their Game Boys out or whatever on like a, you know, toy swap day at school. So in terms of how this stacked up with, you know, the early Game Boy experiences in general, because I mean we've talked about some of the specific limitations that there were on trying to put a Metroid type experience, and they are very significant. But I mean there were plenty of constraints on making any kind of experience in the early days of the Game Boy. To the people that had Game Boys back then among us here, how much more do you think it suffers than some of those experiences that might have been better suited to a portable?
Well, you know, I had one in 91.
Yeah.
I had one in 89.
So basically, most of the stuff out was puzzle games. There was a lot of non-puzzle games out there, but a lot of it were like Tetris and stuff like that. But I think this game came out in 92. I'm not positive. I'm going to get a laugh on this one, but it is a Castleroids game. It's Kid Dracula.
Hell yeah,
I've
Kid
heard
Dracula.
Good things about that.
It was still a little bit exploration driven.
Yeah, because you could turn into a bat and fly around, yeah.
Right. It worked well with what it had, knowing that it was a Game Boy game. And I think that I would much rather play that than Metroid 2.
What you say is that didn't have some of the overreach kind
yeah,
of
it,
issues.
Yeah, it managed expectations well, because it knew... It knew what it was and said, okay, I have to work within those confines.
It was very much a room-by-room game. You know, it kind of reminds me of some of the more advanced Kirby games.
A little bit. It's a little bit like Castleroids meets Kirby in a way.
Well, maybe we will play Kid Dracula on a
no,
future
we won't,
retroactive.
Because it's hard as shit to get.
We're going to have to cut it short here, guys. But thank you for participating, especially you, Zach. Thanks for coming on as a guest and helping out here. I can see why people like us to talk about Metroid, because we obviously grasp the task with zeal.
Zest.
What are they saying, Nintendogs again? Is it vim and vigor?
Vim and vigor, yeah. So I hope people weren't too bored listening to us talk about Metroid 2 for so long. We actually have overrun our schedule a little bit, so we're going to have to put off listener mail for next time.
And that was the last time RFN ever discussed Metroid.
There's a new game coming out in
nope,
a few
no,
minutes.
No, there's not. We're done. Series is over.
Sorry.
James hasn't looked at the release calendar lately.
Move along. We're done.
We'll do some E3 drunk casts with Metroid for sure.
So please do send in your emails. We have been getting some good ones. The address is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Let us know what you thought of Retroactive and ask us anything, and we will definitely catch up next week on those. So with that, thanks for listening. Check out Radio Trivia and NWR Newscast, and we will see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
See ya.
Later.
Fuck them dinos.
Did you cry during Turok?
I did, but for different reasons.
Yeah.
I liked when it came, again, when it came out, I thought the first Turok was awesome.
I just remember playing Turok Rage Wars going, yep, this is well named.
Oh, Rage Wars. That's the multiplayer spin-off thing.
Yeah. Multiplayer one, it's like, let's make some money off of our engine, that game.
Well, can you imagine in Aliens if Ripley, at the very end, kills the queen and then basically takes on her last little baby alien as a pet?
Yeah, that would be a little weird. When you turn it around like that, I don't know. Metroids are cuter than chest huggers, though. Chest bursters.
Well,
that is true. Kind of. I mean, all they want is energy.
I mean, that's all they want.
They don't want to lay eggs down your throat.
Oh, boy.
Democracy.